and welcome to a special Australia Day edition of Life Matters. I'm Hilary Harper and we're devoting much of today to a conversation around one of our fastest growing sciences. It's having a profound effect on how we live, what work we do, and what it means to be human.
This is our future.
It's the rise of artificial intelligence, or AI, which, through its ability to learn way faster than we can, could be one of our greatest tools or greatest threats. Toby Walsh is Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales. His latest book is called 2062, The World That AI Made. And Michael McKenzie sat down with Professor Walsh in front of a live audience at the inaugural Jaipur Literature Festival in Adelaide.
Toby, not only are you Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales, let me just read out some of Toby's other qualifications for being here. He's the Fellow of the Australian Academy of Science. He's the Fellow of the European Association for Artificial Intelligence. And you're also the Fellow of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. And I deliberately put that one last, Toby, because having read your latest book, which is called 2062, The World That AI Made, I'm terrified about the advancement of artificial intelligence. And I suspect in some of your moments, you're terrified too.
I am pessimistic in the short term. I think it's a very bumpy road the next couple of decades that we face, you know, a tsunami of problems. I mean, not just the technological disruption of our lives, but our disrupted political discourse now that we see being amplified in many settings, the climate change, you know, really wicked problems like climate change that we are just not dealing with in any way at all, the global refugee problem, the global financial crisis, the completely distorted economic situation that we now live in, increasing inequality with our society. So just a raft of problems. And I just have to apologise to young people. You know, what a world we're leaving them with. But in the long term, I'm optimistic just because that's what's got humankind through all of the problems in the past. And we've always embraced technology. We've always come out of it after turbulent periods better. Life expectancy in this country has doubled since the Industrial Revolution. Your risk of dying a violent death has decreased by a factor of 10. Life has got much better. But we have gone through some bumpy periods, and I think we're going through another one of those bumpy periods, and we really do have to think about changing our society like we did in the past. And that's why I wrote the book, to try and say, let's have this conversation. Mm. Let's think about how technology is changing our lives. Let's think about how technology can help improve our lives. And it can be used for good or for bad. It's like all technologies. It's completely neutral. And it's all about the choices that we as a society need to make sure it's a better world.
Well, let's tease some of this out, shall we? Let's start with the title of the book. I'm dead chuffed, because how did you know I was turning 100 in 2062? I suspect that isn't the reason why you've given that date as a title. Tell people why.
So there are three reasons. There's a technological reason, which is that I surveyed 300 of my colleagues, other people working in AI, and that was their average estimate of when machines would be as smart as us. Well, the arithmetic average was never, because 8% of them said never. But 50% of them said before 2062, and 50% said after 2062. There's a huge, great variation. I mean, it's not going to happen on June the 3rd at 5 p.m. on 2062. It's going to happen sometime.
Because that is my birthday.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Fantastic.
There was a huge variation in the answers. But the expectation is it's not going to take 10 years. It's not, as you don't have to worry tonight that it's going to happen that quickly. Equally, it's not going to take 1,000 years. It's going to be sometime in the next 50, 100 years, probably. Maybe if we're unlucky or lucky, depending on your perspective, maybe it might be 200 years. But it's that sort of order of magnitude. It's within the lifetime easily of our children. Maybe if we are lucky enough, we might actually even be around just in time to see it ourselves.
Maybe. Maybe we'll be lucky enough to be around. Or maybe we will be lucky enough not to be around.
Yes.
Because depending on how we govern ourselves between now and 2062 is, as you said at the front of this conversation, instrumental in how artificial intelligence either rules us or supplants us or cooperates with us. There's so many governing factors that we have yet to deal with. So let's talk about one of the ones that scared the pants off me at the front of your book. Okay. And that is the rise of a new species you call Homo digitalis. Tell us about Homo digitalis.
Yeah, so it's about how increasingly we're outsourcing things that we used to do to machines. I mean, we used to remember telephone numbers. No one remembers telephone numbers. There's only one telephone number that anyone remembers nowadays. It's their own, which is ironic because you can't call yourself. Because
and 999.
And 999 or 000. But long seven or nine digit numbers, none of us ever remember because the machines do that. We're the last generation probably that will know how to map read. And that actually has a profound consequence because they've done experiments with people who do the knowledge, the driving test for taxi drivers in London. And it physically changes the size of the hippocampus. You can physically measure the change in people's brains.
This is a part of the brain that governs spatial awareness?
Spatial awareness and spatial memory. So that physically changes us. And there's lots of examples how people have, you know, someone's actually driven off a cliff following a satellite navigation system because we are just blind trustworthy. And there are plenty of examples of people getting into trouble. So it's one of those skills that will depart us. And then you have to say, well, you know, are we going to be lesser for that?
So when do you think Homo digitalis as a species, if we can use that term, becomes so self-aware that we become a tool of them?
Well, so the interesting question then is, will machines ever become self-aware?
Yes.
Will they always be our slaves? Because that's what they are at the moment. They have no consciousness, no feelings, no desires of their own. They do exactly what we tell them to do. Or will they at some time ever become conscious, sentient, and have goals of their own? We have no idea. I mean, that's one reason why artificial intelligence is one of the most interesting, profound sciences to study at the moment, because it will maybe help us understand one of the most important parts of our existence, which is when you woke up this morning, you became aware of your surroundings, and till you fall asleep tonight into asleep, you will be aware of yourself. You're conscious of your existence, and it's in some sense the most important part of ourself. Whether machines will ever have anything that approaches that. At the moment, they have nothing like that. But there is the possibility, a real possibility, that the machines, as we build them, increasingly complex machines, may start to take on some of those characteristics themselves. It's so hard to know what that will be because we know so little about our own consciousness. It's so important to our existence, yet we have no way of measuring it. There's no scientific device for measuring that you're conscious. I assume you're conscious because you look like me, you behave like someone who's conscious. I assume my dog is somewhat conscious, maybe less conscious than a human, and then we assume that the ants are probably have very little in the way of consciousness. So it's something that complex brains seem to have. Whether it's something that can only ever be in biology or something that could be in silicon, we have no idea. Maybe we will build machines that become conscious. There are three ways that it could happen. One is that it sort of emerges out of complexity. There are plenty of, it seems to be connected to complex brains, and so maybe if we build complex enough systems, they emerge. The second way is that we teach it. They learn to be conscious. Most of the things we do, we learn.
And we're quite slow learners compared to machines, aren't we?
We're very slow learners compared to machines.
Because machines can practice a task or learn from making mistakes with a task millions of times and never have to go to sleep or go and do another job or tend to the family or drive a car. They can just focus on that one task and get really good at it quite quickly.
Yes, and that's why we're going to be surprised by machines, because we're used to learning the painful, slow way that humans do. And so, for example, if you learn to ride a bicycle, it doesn't really help
me.
I'm still
in counselling over that.
You're still in counselling.
No, seriously, it took me, I was so unco, that I fell off it for a good 6 months.
Great. Well, you finally succeeded, but there's a limit to what you can communicate to me to learn to ride a bicycle with someone else.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to fall off the bicycle myself and learn it. Whereas with computers, they don't have any of that failing. We can just share the code. Once we've learned, one computer's learned how to drive a car, we can share that code. So computers can learn on a planet-wide scale. We're used to learning everything from scratch for ourselves. Just because you've learned to speak German doesn't help me to speak German.
No.
But with computers, it does. So we can share, and then they can learn much faster than real time. They can learn at whatever speeded up time that we can play.
From the moment that code is placed in one portal that allows that code to be disseminated across a number of different terminals or different functioning machines, they've all got the ability to ride a bike. It yes. took me 6 months in counselling to get through.
And that actually is already happening in our world today. People don't realise it, but you know, every night Tesla upload the code from all the Teslas on the planet and share the driving experiences so that the Teslas get better and better. And it's like a ratchet that that they will get to be the best drivers on the planet because they'll have experienced everything there is to see on the planet. And then it's shared amongst all of the Teslas and then it's never forgotten. So unlike all the things we learn and forget. So we will be surprised by how quickly machines learn things and how quickly that's disseminated around the planet.
Well, Toby, I'm sensing they... people might even be shocked and horrified. I heard moans of, oh.
But that's great because it's a huge, great tragedy. 1,000 people in Australia will die in the next year in road traffic accidents, 95% of which are caused by some idiot driving and some driving error made by a human.
All right, so we're going to go to driverless cars as quickly, are we? All right, if you want to go there, let's do this.
And
okay.
That's a huge, great burden, not just a financial burden. It's $1 billion a year because each of those car accidents costs $1 million to deal with, but a huge, great tragedy. If you ask anyone in the audience here, everyone will know someone's life who was touched by a car accident.
Yeah.
Someone who was killed, someone they knew, or someone in their immediate circle who was touched by this. We just will look back in 50 years' time and think, how did we put up with this?
You're with Life Matters at the inaugural Jaipur Literature Festival in Adelaide. I'm Michael McKenzie, and my guest is Professor of Artificial Intelligence Toby Walsh from the University of New South Wales. And we're discussing Android Dreams, the world that AI made. So, all right, let's assume, and in fact it's happening, as you say, in the next 2 years at least, I think some car manufacturers, Tesla's one of them, I think Holden and Ford are already talking about it too.
Most of them are saying they are selling fully autonomous cars, level 5, by 2025. Now, even if they're wrong, even if it's 2030, that's still I have a bet my daughter, who's 9 now, that she'll never learn to drive. In 10 years' time, when she's of the age to learn to drive, that it will be, it's expensive, difficult, as it should be. It's a dangerous activity. And it will be so much easier, so much more convenient just to get some super Uber service that will take her and she'll be able to go out and drink and party and do all the things she wants. And I'll be so much happier that one of her friends who has barely learned to drive is not driving her home. She'll get home much more safely. So all of us will be much happier and she'll never get to learn to drive. It's like we're back to map reading.
One of those skills. I was going to say, what happens to the hippocampus, though, in someone who never gets to experience a spatial awareness of placing an object in the right space on the road in relation to other people who are also keeping their space on the road?
There will be driving and it's going to be like horse riding. So it used to be 100 years ago, all of us would horse ride, all of us would go around on horse and cart and most people had that skill. Nowadays, it's a hobby for the very rich.
Okay.
And that's what's going to happen to driving. It's going to be a hobby for the very rich who can afford the expensive insurance premiums. And why will autonomous cars be far better than humans? Well, one thing is that's the only thing they'll be doing. They'll be laser focused on driving. They won't be texting. They won't be distracted. They won't be tired. They won't be making all the other mistakes. Hopefully, they won't be thinking about the soap opera they saw last night or anything else. They'll be thinking about driving, only thinking about driving, and they'll have senses that we don't have. They'll see in wavelengths that we don't see. So they have the potential to be much better drivers than us and not make the mistakes we do. But we have to be very careful how we introduce them into our lives to make sure that that's the case. And I don't think we're actually going about it yet in that way. Ultimately, it's going to be like aviation. When aviation started, it was terribly dangerous. Cars would fall out of the sky all the time. But we put in the safeguards.
Planes, I think you'll find they were planes, actually.
Oh, sorry, cars were falling out. Planes were falling out of the sky all the time. Terribly disastrous. Cars were falling out of the plane. Yeah, the flying car was never going to take off.
Oh.
Although, actually, the flying car is going to take off. Two of my friends actually are CEOs of companies that are building flying cars.
But they're not autonomous, I hope.
Oh, yes, they will be. That's the only reason that we never... People always ask me, well, the future never happened. You know, what happened to all the flying cars? And I say, well, the flying cars had to wait till we had autonomous cars because we can't trust humans to fly. Most humans aren't capable of flying a plane. So we weren't going to get flying cars till we had autonomous cars that could fly themselves. Now we've got to that point, we can actually build flying cars.
What's, I think, reassuring for those of us who enjoy being human is that... I think some of the major airlines are still saying they need 600,000 extra pilots in the next 20 years.
Yes, and how it will happen is that the freight planes will be turned into autonomous planes because it will be far cheaper.
Right, like trucks.
Like trucks. And then after about 10 years, well, people will notice the freight planes aren't crashing anymore and the only passenger planes are crashing, and people will start to say, well, can't we have that safety on passenger planes? And then people will demand that it's only autonomous passenger planes.
That's the old analogy of the warm water and the frog.
Yes.
Yeah. So is this the optimistic part of AI? Because I'm a bit lost now.
Well, I'm a little worried. For the rest of us, it actually will liberate us. If you think the city has been defined by the car, the driven car, the autonomous car will redefine the city. So it's easy to think of the primary consequences of technologies like AI about how, well, we're not going to be driving and maybe we'll forget how to drive.
In fact, we'll be working because the car becomes another extension of the office. Or any other workplace, because you don't have to look up. You can spend your entire time on a digital screen while another digital component takes care of your travel.
Yeah, so the optimistic view is then that time we wasted commuting is going to be given to us. We can actually say, well, we could start work an hour later because the first hour we spend in the car, we can get through, clear our emails and start our work and similarly at the end of the day. So that means that then we can go out and live in places that we want to live. We're not forced to live close to the city in unaffordable housing. Note to self, go and buy shares in countryside real estate agents because the price of property in the country is going to now go up, which means that we fix that problem of...
Well, hang on, you still haven't solved the problem, and there's so much to discuss here. You still haven't solved the problem of the fact that a car exerts a position on a road in a physical space that has to get from A to B. So commuting may be more ordered and more organised and far more safe, but it's still occupying a space on our roads that are bloated with cars. So that problem isn't solved. Can I just leave that, though, to one side?
Okay.
Because there's other things I want to talk about with this. The morality of AI. How does an AI driverless car, an autonomous car, make, and this is what everyone's wrestling with in that level 5 coding area that you discussed earlier, Toby Walsh, about making the right moral decision that have been left to humans until now. When there's an emergency and you have one or two options or three options and all of them involve some degree of human carnage, what happens?
We don't have a good answer. I mean, this is the famous trolley problem. Who are you going to kill? Are you going to drive into the wall and kill the occupants of the car? Are you going to drive into the pedestrians who've stepped into the road? We don't have a good answer, but we haven't had a good answer for 100 years. Every time you've ever got...
But at least we had someone to blame.
You're right. That's the difference. And whenever we got in a car today, you might have faced one of these scenarios and you have a split second to make a decision. If you survived the accident and you did the wrong thing, you might be facing charges of manslaughter. And that's the same problem that we now face with machines, except the two things is that we don't have... The machine can't be responsible because it's a machine. It has no moral conscience, it can't suffer, it can't be punished, so we can't punish the machine.
So do we punish the corporation that coded the machine?
It's more complex than that even, because is it the corporation that made the machine? Is it the data that it was exposed to? Because maybe it learned some of those behaviours. So these are complex moral questions. The interesting thing is that my friends who write software for autonomous cars, they're not interested in the problem because the car is so unaware of its surroundings. All it's trying to do is not have an accident. Its main loop is avoid hitting things and then brake as quickly as possible. There is no sense, it doesn't actually understand the world well enough to actually be able to make these decisions yet. And it certainly can't say, oh, I can see that's a young person, that's an old person, I'm going to make a decision. Do I kill the young person or kill the old person? It doesn't understand the world enough to be making these moral distinctions. But it highlights, I mean, it's interesting, it highlights how we will be handing decisions over to machines where we have to make these decisions up front. And this means, I think we're going to go through a golden age of philosophy where we have to come up with good answers to these questions. We don't have a good answer to this question yet today. I mean, interesting historical aside, the trolley problem was actually 50 years old. It was introduced into modern philosophy 50 years ago.
Now, you say the trolley problem. Just explain why you mentioned the word trolley.
Well, it was used originally to describe a runaway railway trolley, a runaway railway cart that was going down a track, and you could throw the switch and turn it onto a siding, and it was going to run into five people on the main track, and if it ran into the siding...
So it's the same moral conundrum.
It would run into just one person, so you had to make a choice as to who to save, who to kill, and you had to take a physical action to do that.
The difference now is, in autonomous cars, the person who purchased the car purchased it probably at a sizable premium from a corporation that values their patronage.
Yes, they do.
And you raise this in your book, throughout the book actually, about the moral fibre, the moral codage, both digital and analogue, of our society when it comes to the role of corporations in the governing of those kind of products. What are you suggesting we should be doing as we try to face and wrestle with these moral conundrums? What are you suggesting we do with corporations such as Tesla, such as Microsoft and Apple, Google, in terms of their influence on our digital futures?
I think we have to think seriously about regulating and reforming them. If I told you that there was a pharmaceutical company that was testing its drugs on the public without any ethical oversight, without any consent from the public, and they knew that they would be killing people. You say, well, that doesn't happen in Australia, does it? Or it doesn't happen in the United States, but it does happen with autonomous cars.
Well, it happens in the developing world
and
now.
And it happens in the developing world. We should be outraged when it does happen. And we have decided that, drugs should be tested only with ethical oversight and approval and checks and balances put into place. But we don't seem to be doing that with autonomous cars. It's a capitalist race to decide, who's going to be the first to be selling fully autonomous cars. And we don't know yet today whether, for example, autonomous cars are safer than human-driven cars.
Well, what's the point of them if they're not? I mean, isn't that the point?
Well, eventually they will. Eventually they'll probably be much safer than human cars. But that's an interesting moral question. How much safer do they have to be?
A lot safer. Because we have no tolerance for digital mistakes.
From a moral perspective, as soon as they are 1% safer than human drivers, we should probably ban all human drivers and only let autonomous cars be there. But that's probably not what's going to happen. We're going to have to demand that they're 10 times 100. What is the threshold? It's an interesting question as to what is the threshold? What does society think is the right, appropriate threshold? So this, to come back to, is why I think it's going to be the golden age of philosophy the next 50 years or so, because we're going to have to make very concrete all these moral decisions because we're giving them to machines. And machines are very literal devices. They do literally what we tell them to do. We have to make these moral decisions up front, and they're in a very precise way that we encoded into concrete computer code, that decisions that as a society we've sort of skated over about these sorts of things, like the trolley problem, about matters of fairness and equality and so on. And we're giving machines the right to make those decisions, to decide who gets welfare, who gets a mortgage. And we have to be very careful that those decisions reflect the values of the society we want them to be, that they're racially unbiased, that they're not biased between the sexes or the ages and the things that we've been trying to fix in our society for the last 50, 100 years.
I want to get back to that. You're with Life Matters at the inaugural Jaipur Literature Festival in Adelaide. I'm Michael McKenzie, and my guest is Professor of Artificial Intelligence Toby Walsh from the University of New South Wales. And we're discussing Android Dreams, the world that AI made.
Some of us will embrace it. Others will fear it.
They made us too smart, too quick, and too many.
Toby Walsh, let's talk jobs.
Yes.
We're being told that more than half of our current jobs could be automated in the next 20 years, but you dispute those claims.
Yes, I think it's a really important conversation we should be having, that the nature of work is going to change significantly. It's been rightly called the fourth industrial revolution. And there have been some very worrying predictions made that half of all jobs are at risk of automation in the next 2 decades. That doesn't mean for sure that half of all people will be unemployed. Lots of new jobs will be created. And lots of the predictions, I think, are a little bit optimistic. I mean, one of the predictions was that bicycle repair person was going to be automated. Well, I know none of my colleagues, other researchers in AI, trying to build bicycle repair robots.
I mean, it's hard enough as a human to get the inner tube out.
It is. It's a difficult, fiddly job. So you need a very expensive robot. And bicycle repair people aren't well paid. So I don't think that job is going to go anytime
soon. Well, bicycle repair people around the world are breathing a sigh of relief.
They are. The interesting thing is, you know, what are the skills that are going to resist automation? And they're the very human skills. Social intelligence, emotional intelligence, creativity, adaptability, the things that make us, you know, very human, the things that we're going to resist automating, things that we appreciate already. And you can see it in hipster culture, how we appreciate, you know, handmade bread and artisan cheese. And we're going back in time in some respects. You know, the newest job on the planet being an Uber driver, one of the shortest lived jobs on the planet.
Why is that?
Uber is already trialing autonomous taxis. And it's going to be far cheaper, far safer. Taxes are going to be the price of buses once we have the most expensive thing eliminated from the car, which is the driver.
What about truck drivers?
And similarly with truck drivers. So if you're one of those people, you have to seriously think, what other skill have you got? Because I'm not sure driving is something that we're going to afford to have people do for much longer. Because if you've got an autonomous truck, it can drive 24/7. It doesn't have to stop every 8 hours and take a rest. You can use that truck so much more efficiently. It will drive so much more smoothly. It will use energy so much better. It will be able to slipstream all the other trucks. So it will make a lot of sense to trucking companies not to employ people to invest in these new technologies.
And autonomous cars won't be blown off the road by road trains because they've already factored in the wind shearing speed as the truck goes past.
So for most people, it would be great news. The cost of transportation will plummet. Cost of supplying goods to us will go down. One-tenth of the cost of everything in Australia is the cost of getting it to you. And that will go down. So we'll see great benefits. But if you're a truck driver, then probably you need to start thinking, what other skill have I got?
Okay. I want to talk about some other jobs too. We don't have to be yes and no answers to this.
Radio presenter?
I'm irreplaceable, Toby.
Yeah, irreplaceable. Yeah, well, you only had to see the news on Friday where they had a TV presenter in China, which is now completely computer-generated.
And how was that presenter?
They're okay. It's still early days, but it shows how we can now generate, you know, these deep fakes, completely synthetic video that looks just like a person, Obama, Trump, whoever it is, saying things that they never said. Unless you were there in person and saw it with your own eyes, you won't know it didn't happen.
So in effect, my job will be on the dustbin of life because no one believes me anyway. No, I'm serious. I mean, everyone will think I'll have some kind of agenda.
Yes, I mean that's, I think, one of the really troubling things about how, and I'm not sure that we have good answers to this, how are we going to deal with this, the fact that even Trump today is saying, you know, fake news, denying things that, you know, he's been caught on tape saying, oh, it's all just fake news.
Yeah.
And in some sense, it will actually give politicians a buyout because they'll be able to say, previously, if you were caught on camera, if you were caught on tape saying something or you were filmed doing something, you couldn't deny it happened.
No.
But now we know that we can synthesize that video. And people can just say, oh, it's just fake news.
Let's go back to some other jobs that people actually care about in their lives. Yes or no?
Well, politician, actually, I think, is the last job that will be automated because the politicians will legislate that it's the last job that can be automated.
True enough. Unless, of course, the Russians somehow make some kind of automaton or avatar who precludes real people from doing it.
Well, there is a Trump bot called Deep Drumpf. Drumpf was the German original name of Trump.
This is on Twitter, isn't it?
It's on Twitter. And it is pretty, it was trained on all his tweets and it produces new tweets, which are pretty indistinguishable from the real thing. I mean, it's not a high bar to pass, Trump, but we're pretty much there already.
Okay, as I said, back to jobs we care about. Human doctors, by 2062 or even earlier, will they be treating us still?
I think we'll still want human doctors to help interpret the results of all the machines. So GPs, I think, are pretty safe because we want someone, you know, who says to me, "Well, Toby, I'm afraid we've got bad news from the machines. You've got only 6 months to live. It's inoperable cancer." We prefer a human to break that news to us and help us, you know, live through that situation.
But you're just full of good news, aren't you? And cheer.
But the specialists, I mean, we can already read X-rays better with a machine than a human could do it. We could do it quicker, cheaper, faster, more accurately than a human could do it. We can read mammograms better with a machine than humans can do it. And that means that's going to democratize the medical knowledge. And in fact, you know, my dream is one day we'll put all of these things on a smartphone app and have them in the third world and not just in the first world.
Can you hold that thought about the smartphone apps? Because I want to get back to that as well. Back to other jobs. Human baristas. Will I ever be around to make coffee in the future?
Will
I still have man buns?
I mean, that's a good example because in a mechanical sense, you know, we can already build a machine. You press a button, as long as you clean the machine properly, it does a better job, a more reliable job of making a cup of coffee. But it shows that actually we prefer the social side of it. It's the fact the barista is going to flirt with you or crack a joke that means you're
willing to... Or tell you the provenance of the coffee.
I'll tell you the provenance of the coffee and remember from yesterday and say, "I remember what you wanted." That's human relationships that we will increasingly value, and we'll pay extra for that. And that may be, for many of us, sadly, you know, one of the most meaningful human experiences we'll have that day, and we'll have paid extra for it.
I should explain to people too, if you think this is him just being a little pessimistic now, you should read the book. After the first chapter, which is called Homo Digitalis, every other chapter starts with the end of. Seriously, second chapter, the end of us. That's the second chapter. The end of consciousness, the end of work, the end of war, the end of human values, and so you go on.
The end of work should be good news. We should be celebrating machines taking jobs.
Why?
Because, especially the jobs they're taking today, because they're taking the dull, repetitive jobs that are inhumane, and we should never have got humans ever to have done them.
Such as?
I mean, such as getting people to work on assembly lines. We turn people literally into robots. And that's something that we should never have done. And that when we can get robots to do those machines again, we should be celebrating. And we have to work out how to make sure that those people have, you know, useful roles to provide in society and are provided for so they're not thrown onto the scrap heap for unemployment. But we should be celebrating that we get given that time back to do the things that are important to us, to spend time with our families, to spend time in our communities, to do the things that make us a human.
But Toby, can I say, even with the most menial of jobs, what it does give people, as much as they may loathe the job, is a sense of awayness and apartness from the things they value. And that actually makes what they value more valuable. So there's an intensity about something that is only an option at parts of your day, that is an option all the time, then everything's leisure and nothing has meaning.
Well, I think we do have to start to think about whether the nature of work changes. I mean, it does unfortunately define many of our lives as it is today. But the nature of work has changed through the first industrial revolution, where we now work much less. We spend a lot more time playing and buying toys and doing things with our lives that we didn't have the time, we didn't have the freedoms to do before the first industrial revolution. We literally got up in the morning when the sun got up, went to work in the fields and came home when the sun went down and went to bed tired, and that was it.
It was very physical, it was very demanding. I have no doubt, and you were very poorly paid, and your conditions at work were unsafe and inhumane, and perhaps your working life is terrible generally and your home life was underprivileged. But we have people now in our modern society who are working 16-hour days, coming home exhausted and feeling terrible about themselves, about their families and about their future.
Indeed, and that's something that we really have to worry about, the fact that whilst prosperity has increased, it's not being shared around.
Okay.
That median wage, for example, has not in real terms increased dramatically in the United States since the 50s and in Australia since about the 80s or the 90s, that we have seen the rich get much richer and many of the rest of us being left behind. And if it weren't for the fact that more of us were working more hours, we will be way behind in terms of, we need to think about how we distribute the wealth, how we make sure all of us share the prosperity that the technology is bringing to our lives. And that is not happening.
That is not happening. So I'm just wondering, aren't you concerned, deeply concerned, as perhaps people are here, that artificial artificial intelligence will only amplify what's wrong with the way we govern ourselves.
I am deeply, deeply concerned, which is why I wrote the book. And one of the chapters is called The End of Equality, saying that the brief period of increasing equality that we saw, the introduction of the welfare state and Medicare, all those wonderful things that happened at the end of the war that gave us a fair society, are starting to run out, and we're starting to see a much more broken society, a much more discontented society, rightly so, because that prosperity is not being shared around. And technology, if left to its own devices, will only amplify that. We have a good historical precedent, which was the first Industrial Revolution. And out of that, we did increase prosperity and we did increase equality, but not by sitting back and letting, as you know, Marx would have us believe, the owners of the production take all of the wealth. We did some redistribution, some serious redistribution. We introduced unions and labor laws, in universal education, we introduced the pension. We made some significant structural changes to society so that all of us shared the benefits.
I'm going to interrupt again because I keep wanting to take you to task. I hope that's okay.
Yes.
But, you know, in all those areas you've mentioned of reformation, of how people's lives were improved by that kind of disruption and interjection of better laws and better regulations, that's because we care about people.
Yes.
Because in the end, what separates us from machines is that we have compassion and kindness and we like to cooperate because of those feelings. Okay, not just because we've been programmed to. Why should we care about regulating a better world with AI when we don't give a crap about machines?
No, we shouldn't care about the machines. Certainly, unless they have consciousness, unless they have feelings, they should have no rights. That'll be the good thing is they never become conscious, because then they literally will be our slaves and we don't have to care about them. So that would be a lucky break for us that they never become
conscious.
Until,
of course, they become homo digitalis and supplant us and make us all their minions.
But hopefully they will always be our servants, that we won't have to care about them, and we care about each other. And we are social animals. We've made, for better or worse, we dominate the planet because we built societies. We're much, individually, each of us wouldn't stand a chance on the savannah. We'd be eaten by the first lion. But we got together in societies and we are gone to the moon and back. We've sent roadsters into space. We've done amazing things, built amazing buildings, discovered amazing knowledge, built works of art that amaze and bring you to tears, because we worked as a society. And that's what always has held us together. And that does worry to me today, to see our societies being increasingly fractured. And technology is not helping that. But that's all about saying, and the book is making these points, which is, let's make sure that we use the technology in a way that can actually help bring our society back together and not make it further divided, not make it increase the inequality within our society, not increase the corrosiveness of our political discourse. Let's use the technologies in ways that will actually make it a more cohesive society, which all of us get a fair go.
My guest is Professor Toby Walsh, who's the Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales. And let's take some questions.
Toby, I wonder if a chapter that's perhaps missing from your book is the chapter with the title, The End of Capitalism. I wonder, however, are you somebody who assumes that capitalism is forever? Or even by the year 2062, do you think we need to imagine a world with somewhat more intelligent machines still having to exist in a world of capitalists that are more and more stupid?
It's worth remembering that the modern corporation is an invention of the first Industrial Revolution, that we give corporations great freedom to act in our free markets these days. And that's been, greatly beneficial. We've generated, vast prosperity and wealth out of that. But those freedoms, I think, are perhaps being somewhat abused these days, and that we may need to think, and the book suggests some ideas as to how we may need to reform the idea of the modern corporation so that it acts more in line with the public good, because modern corporations are not acting in line with the public good. They're not seeming to want to pay their fair share of taxes. Tech companies pay an effective tax rate of about 10% compared to more than 20% for old-fashioned corporations, which is remarkable, because they could afford to pay more taxes because they have amazing profit margins that they could afford to pay taxes on. But they don't actually have anything to do with the spare cash they generate other than buy back their shares. which is rather the laziest thing you can do with spare capital.
Other questions?
Don't you think most dangerous period is the interim period between total automation? Because at the moment, I had a car completely right off because a guy backed out, looking at his reversing camera, not realising he's still got to look both ways. So doesn't humanity have to grasp all this automation in the interim period before it becomes total?
Yes, you're right. The most difficult, the most dangerous period is the period in between as we go, where we have a mixture of humans and machines making the decisions and humans trusting machines too much. And Joshua Brown, the first guy killed by his autonomous car, learned this to his cost, that we'll trust the machines too much. And once it's only autonomous cars on the road, it's going to be far safer because they'll speak to each other. They'll V2V, vehicle-to-vehicle radio. They'll be able to talk to each other and tell each other what they're doing. So the difficult period is when we're mixed in between. And at some point, for our own safety, we'll probably be banned from driving.
Just on that very fact, can I just add to that and ask you, where is your campaign, along with many of your colleagues, up to, just quickly, on your push for an international ban on autonomous lethal weapons?
But equally, it can be used to fight war, and I've found myself a bit of an accidental activist speaking at the United Nations on this very issue, talking about trying to ban killer robots, as they get called, lethal autonomous weapons. And there's growing momentum, I'm pleased to say, about that. 26 nations now have called for a preemptive ban. Most recently, we had the European Parliament vote to call for that ban. I'm ashamed to say that one nation that has explicitly sat on our hands is Australia. And despite the fact that we've led disarmament discussions in many other fora, for many other types of technologies, for biological weapons, for chemical weapons, we are just following the line of the United States at the moment, which is a great pity because we have a unique role in some sense. We're not a member of NATO. We sit somewhere between the nations. And yet we have a significant voice that we could use to make the world a better place. And not, it will, I'm sure, if we do nothing, it will actually end up looking like one of these terrible Hollywood movies.
I just want to ask you something about privacy.
Yes.
At the moment, our rights to digital privacy are constantly being eroded. But you're concerned, are you not, too, about the loss of privacy of our analog data as well?
Indeed, yes. So maybe we've lost that battle for our digital privacy, but there's another battle that's about to start that I would very much hope we learn the lesson from giving up our digital privacy, which is that we're connecting ourselves to devices, to our Fitbits, to our smartwatches that monitor our analog selves, our heartbeat, our blood pressure, the dilation of our pupils. These are signals, unlike our digital preferences, that you can't lie about. And if you read the terms of service of companies like Fitbit, you don't own the data about the most private thing about yourself, your heartbeat. And imagine what marketers could do with that information about how you respond physically.
Of course, if they know that your heart's a bit, dicky,
yes,
you could be getting sort of invitations to a nursing home in the mail.
You would. And, they could say, well, I've got some very important information. You're going to have they could literally tell whether you're going to have a stroke in the next day or something. How much you would they be able to charge you for this information? So it's worrying to think that what marketeers could do with this sort of information. But if you want the most worrying thought is, what could politicians do? If they could read your heartbeat when they were saying a speech, that they could see how the population responded. And it's,
maybe their speeches would improve. Finally, biofeedback for how terrible they are.
Yes. But those most private things, you can't lie about these things. You can lie about subvert your digital presence, but you can't subvert your analog presence.
Toby Walsh, I'd like to try and see if we can, on behalf of your daughter, who's now nine, and our children from this audience here, who in 2062 will be in their mid to late 50s, maybe more.
That's the spooky thing about the book. When I finish writing the book, 2062, my daughter will be exactly my age.
Wow.
Year.
Okay.
I didn't realize that when I wrote the book. It was just a spooky coincidence. It's the world they inherit.
Yeah, it is. The world they inherit. So I want to close, if we can, on a positive but not naive note, if we can manage it, to talk about that if we do get our act together about a second renaissance. What is the second renaissance you speak of in the world of AI?
Well, if we do get things right, the world in 2062 will be quite a different world to the world we live in today. If you go back and think, the world in 1950 looks very different to the world in 1900. not just in the fact that, you know, it's no longer horse and cart, but in terms of the society we live in, the fact that we introduced the welfare state and healthcare and the work we did was quite different. The world was a very different place. I think there's going to be a growing movement to switch off and go back to old-fashioned ways. And you can see that in many aspects of our culture, that we will increasingly value the old-fashioned life that we used to live, the old-fashioned relationships we used to have, and that the devices are giving us these dopamine hits that aren't actually very good for us, and that they're too easily satisfying us, and that there will be an appreciation of those good old values. And that's actually, it's interesting how we, in some sense, our life is going to, our society is going to follow that arc back to the things that we used to value, that sitting around spending time with people, because those are things the machines will never replace, those human values. When people die or close to death and you ask them about their lives, they don't say, I wish I spent more time working. They spend more time with their families, more time in their communities, or more time doing things that are important to them. And if the machines can take the sweat, we can do those things. We can have that time given back to us. And it could be a moment of flowering of creativity where we get the time to go off and create amazing works of art with the assistance of machines who can help us. I can't paint, but with a machine I can. I can't compose, but with a machine I can dream that I can create wonderful works of art.
And you can still take all the credit.
And I can take all the credit, yeah, yes. Yeah. And so it could be, and I say in the book, it could be the second Renaissance. It could be a period of flowering of creativity where we can come back together as a society, as communities, and do the things that are important to us as humans, and let the machines do all the take all the sweat for us.
With a show of hands, let's see how we feel about an AI future. Who feels positive about that future? Show of hands. Oh, that's interesting. And who isn't feeling that optimistic about a future with AI? I have to say, and I'm very surprised, that the optimists win. Will you please thank Professor Toby Walsh?
Toby Walsh, Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales, with Michael McKenzie at the inaugural Jaipur Literature Festival in Adelaide. Toby's latest book is called 2062, The World That AI Made, published by Black Ink, and you can find more details on the Life Matters website.